This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Stalking Jack the Ripper, written by Carrie Maniscalco, read by Nicola Barber. Please enjoy the PDF that accompanies this program. For Grandma, who always loved a good whodunit. Forward. The audiobook you're listening to represents a lot of firsts. It's the first acquisition that I'm publishing under my new imprint for young readers, Jimmy Patterson Books. It's the first young adult novel I chose, thanks to its fresh and compelling take on the ever-fascinating Ripper mystery. It is also Kerry Maniscalco's first novel. And it was when I read her very first line that I knew I was going to love this book. Kerry's clever, vibrant voice and unerring grasp of suspense and emotion came through right from those opening words. Stalking Jack the Ripper is an atmospheric tale full of chilling twists and unsettling turns, and I assure you it more than lives up to the promise of that mesmerizing first sentence. It may be set in Victorian-era London, but you'll find the brilliant and impassioned Audrey Rose to be inspiringly modern, even by our standards. Part of our mission at Jimmy Patterson is to create books that young readers will finish and then immediately say, "Please give me another book." I have no doubt that Stalking Jack the Ripper will be the first of our offerings to fulfill that mission, but it certainly won't be the last. James Patterson. It will have blood, they say. Blood will have blood. Macbeth, Act 3, Scene 4. William Shakespeare. Chapter 1. Preliminary Incision. Dr. Jonathan Wadsworth's Laboratory, Highgate, 30th August, 1888. I placed my thumb and forefinger on the icy flesh, spreading it taut above the breastbone as Uncle had showed me. Getting the preliminary incision correct was imperative. I took my time eyeing the placement of metal upon skin, ensuring proper angling for the cleanest cut. I felt Uncle hovering behind me, studying my every move, but had my view set entirely on the blade in my hand. Without hesitation, I dragged the scalpel from one shoulder to the sternum, taking pains to push as deeply as I could. My brows raised a fraction before I schooled my face into an unreadable mask. Human flesh flayed much easier than I'd anticipated. It wasn't much different from cutting into a pork loin prior to its roasting, a thought that should have been more disturbing than it was. A sickeningly sweet smell wafted from the incision I'd made. This cadaver wasn't as fresh as others. I had a sneaking suspicion not all our subjects were obtained through proper legal or voluntary measures, and was regretting waving away Uncle's earlier offer of a breathing apparatus. Foggy wisps of breath escaped my lips, but I refused to give in to building shivers. I stepped back, my slippers lightly crunching sawdust, and examined my work. Blood barely seeped up from the wound. It was too thick and dead to flow crimson, and too foreign to be truly frightening. Had the man been dead less than 36 hours, it might have spilled onto the table, then onto the floor, saturating the sawdust. I wiped the blade on my apron, leaving an inky streak in its wake. It was a fine incision indeed. I readied myself for the next cut, but Uncle held a hand in the air, stalling my movement. I bit my lip, despising myself for forgetting a step from his lesson so soon. Uncle's ongoing feud with Father, neither one claimed to remember its origin, but I recall it well enough, had him wavering on continuing my apprenticeship. Proving myself incapable would not help my case, especially if I hoped to attend school the next morning. "One moment, Audrey Rose," he said, plucking the soiled blade from my fingers. A sharp scent sprung into the air, mixing with the stench of decaying organs, as Uncle uncorked a bottle of clear liquid and splashed it onto a cloth. Antiseptic was pervasive in his basement laboratory and amongst his blades. I should have remembered to wipe the other one down. I would not make the same mistake again. I glanced about the basement, where several other bodies were lined up along the wall, their pale limbs stiff as snow-covered branches. "We were going to be here all night if I didn't hurry. And Father, the all-important Lord Edmund Wadsworth, would send for Scotland Yard if I wasn't home soon. Given his station, he'd probably have a small army out patrolling for me. Uncle recorked the bottle of carbolic acid, then handed me another scalpel resembling a long, thin dinner knife. Its edge was much sharper than the last blade's was. Using the sterilized tool, I mimicked the same incision on the opposite shoulder, then made my way down to the deceased's navel, stopping just above his belly button. Uncle hadn't warned me how hard it would be, cutting down to the rib cage. I stole a glance at him, but his gaze was fixed hungrily on the corpse. At times the darkness in his eyes terrified me more than the dead we butchered.
"You'll need to crack the ribs open before reaching the heart."
I could tell Uncle was having a difficult time restraining himself from doing the deed. Corpses kept him company most nights, like intriguing textbooks. He cherished dissecting them and discovering the secrets held between the pages of their skin and bones. Before obsession could override his lesson, I quickly broke the ribcage apart, exposing the heart and the rest of the viscera. A foul odor hit me full in the face, and without meaning to, I staggered back, merely placing a hand over my mouth. It was the opening Uncle had been waiting for. He moved forward, but before he could push me aside, I shoved my hands deep into the abdomen, feeling around in squishy membranes until I found what we were looking for. I steeled myself for the task of removing the liver, then accepted the blade from my uncle once more. After a few slices and tugs, the organ came loose. I plopped it onto a waiting specimen tray with a slick thud, resisting the urge to wipe my hands on my apron. Having Uncle's servants wash a little blood was one thing. The gooey blood and mucus now coating my fingers was quite another. We couldn't afford losing another lot of maids, and Uncle could ill afford having any more rumors flitting about. Some people already thought him mad enough.
"What is your medical deduction on how this man expired, niece?"
The liver was in ghastly shape. Several scars ran along its length and width, giving the appearance of dried-out rivers and tributaries. My first guess was this man had been no stranger to his drink. "It appears he died of cirrhosis," I pointed at the scarring. "His liver has been shutting down for quite some time, I believe." I walked around to his head and pulled one of his eyelids back. "Slight yellowing around the whites of his eyes is also present, furthering my suspicion he's been dying quite slowly for several years." I walked back to the liver and carefully removed a cross-section to study under the microscope later, then rinsed it and set it in a jar for preservation. I'd need to label it and add it to the wall of other pickled organs. It was important to keep meticulous records of every post-mortem.
Uncle nodded. "Very good. Very good indeed. And what of..."
The door to the laboratory crashed against the wall, revealing a silhouetted male. It was impossible to see exactly what he looked like or how old he was, with a hat tugged so low over his brow and his overcoat practically touching the ground. But he was very tall. I dared not move, hoping Uncle would brandish a weapon, but he seemed unimpressed with the dark character before us. Ignoring my presence completely, the male focused only on my uncle.
"It's ready, Professor."
His voice was smooth and hinted at youth. I arched a brow, intrigued by what a student and my uncle were up to.
"So soon?"
Uncle checked the clock on the wall, looking at the body on the table, and then at me. I had no idea who the rude boy was or what was ready, but had a feeling it couldn't be anything good at this late hour. Uncle rubbed his chin. After what felt like an eternity, he addressed me with a calculating stare.
"Are you capable of closing the cadaver up on your own?"
I stood taller and thrust my chin up. "Of course." It was truly absurd that Uncle would think me incapable of such an easy thing, especially after I'd been fishing around inside the dead man's viscera well enough on my own. Out of all my tasks, this would be the easiest.
"Aunt Amelia says my needlework is quite impressive," I added.
Except she didn't have skin stitching in mind while praising my embroidery, I'm sure.
"Anyway, I practiced suturing on a boar's carcass over the summer and had no trouble forcing the needles in and out of its derma. This won't be any different."
The dark figure chuckled, a damnably pleasant sound. I kept my expression calm, though I was quietly seething underneath.
There wasn't anything funny about that statement. Whether stitching skin or linen, the craft was what counted, not the medium.
Very well.
Uncle slipped a black overcoat on and removed something I couldn't quite see from a box near his desk.
You may close the body up. Be sure to lock the basement on your way out.
The young man disappeared up the stairs without a backward glance, and I was happy to see him go. Uncle paused at the door, his scarred fingers tapping a nervous beat against the frame.
My carriage will take you home when you're through, he said. Leave the other specimens for tomorrow afternoon.
Uncle, wait! I ran around the examination table. What of school tomorrow? You said you'd let me know tonight. His attention flicked to the gutted cadaver on the table, then back to my expectant face. I could see his mind strategizing and coming up with 1,000 reasons why I should not attend his forensic medicines class. Propriety being the least of his worries. Father would tear him limb from limb if he discovered my apprenticeship. Uncle Jonathan sighed.
You're to come dressed as a boy, and if you so much as utter one word, it will be your first and last time in my classroom. Understand?
I nodded vigorously. I promise, I'll be as silent as the dead.
Ah,
Uncle said, putting a hat on and tugging it low.
The dead speak to those who listen. Be quieter than even them.
Chapter 2 Blood Vengeance. Harrow School for Boys, London, 31st August, 1888.
There wasn't as much blood as one would expect from such a violent throat slashing, according to my uncle. I barely kept up with his account of the gruesome scene he'd attended early this morning, and my notes were looking rather scattered, much like my thoughts.
Tell me, boys,
Uncle Jonathan said, moving about the low stage in the center of the gallery, his pale green eyes pausing on mine before continuing.
What does the evidence suggest if the blood found under the body was already coagulated? Better yet, if there was barely enough blood found to fill but half a pint, what might that say about our victim's end?
The urge to call out the answer was a miserable beast longing to break free from the cage I'd agreed to lock it in. Instead of exercising that demon, I sat quietly with my lips pressed shut and my hat pulled low. I hid my annoyance by scanning my classmates' expressions. I inwardly sighed. Most of them were the same shade of artichoke and looked a breath away from vomiting. How they'd stomach dissecting a cadaver was beyond me. I subtly scraped dried blood from my nail beds, recalling the way it felt to hold a liver in my hands, and wondered what new sensation today's post-mortem would bring. A boy with dark brown hair, as carefully sculpted as his immaculately pressed uniform, raised his hand, straight as an arrow, in the air. Ink blots covered much of his fingertips, as if he were too entranced with writing notes to be bothered with delicacy. My gaze had lingered on him earlier, fascinated by the methodical way he took notes. He was nearly manic with learning, a trait I couldn't help admiring. Uncle nodded toward him. The boy cleared his throat and stood, confidence pulling his lean shoulders back, as he faced the class instead of my uncle. I narrowed my eyes. He was also quite tall. Could he be the mysterious visitor from last night?
It's rather obvious, if you ask me,
he said, his tone bordering on disinterest,
that our murderer either propositioned the deceased for illicit acts to lure her somewhere private, or sneaked up on her, as she was clearly inebriated, and dispatched her from behind.
It was hard to tell, since he'd barely spoken yesterday, but his voice sounded as if it could be that of Uncle's late-night visitor. I found myself leaning closer, as if proximity might spark recognition in my brain. Uncle Jonathan cleared his throat to stall the arrogant boy and sat at his wooden desk. I smiled. Posing as a boy certainly had its merits. Talk of prostitutes always put Uncle on edge, only now he couldn't scold anyone for speaking freely in front of me. He pulled a drawer open, taking a pair of spectacles out and rubbing smudges from them on his tweed jacket before settling them on his face. Leaning forward, Uncle asked,
Why might you believe our victim was assaulted from behind, Thomas, when most of my colleagues believe the victim was lying down when attacked?
I glanced between them. Surprised Uncle had used his Christian name. Now I was almost positive he was the late-night stranger. The boy, Thomas, drew his brows together. Golden brown eyes were perfectly set into an angular face, as if Leonardo da Vinci had painted him himself. If only my lashes were as luxuriant. His chin was squared, giving him a look of steadfast determination. Even his nose was thin and regal, giving an air of alertness to his every expression. If he weren't so infuriatingly aware of his own intelligence, he'd be quite attractive, I supposed.
"Because as you stated, sir, the throat was slashed from left to right. Considering most people are, in fact, right-handed, one would imagine from the downward trajectory you described, and the statistical probability our perpetrator was indeed right-handed, the easiest way to commit this act would be from behind the victim."
Thomas grabbed the student sitting beside him and wrestled him to a standing position, demonstrating his point. Chair limbs screeched against the tiled flooring as the boy struggled to break free, but Thomas held tight, as if he were a boa constrictor with its prey.
"He probably placed his left arm across her chest or torso, dragged her close like so."
He whipped our classmate around.
"And swiftly dragged the blade across her throat. Once while standing, then twice as she fell to the ground, all before she knew what was happening."
After simulating the near beheading, Thomas dropped the boy and stepped over him, returning to both his seat and his former disinterest.
"If you were to investigate blood splatter at a slaughterhouse, I'm sure you'd find something like an inverse pattern, as livestock are typically killed while dangling upside down."
"Ha!" Uncle clapped his hands with echoing force. I jumped at his outburst, relieved most of the class jolted in their wooden seats along with me. There was no denying Uncle was passionate about murder.
"Then why, naysayers cry, didn't blood splatter all over the upper portion of the fence?"
Uncle challenged, pounding a fist in his palm.
"When her jugular was severed, it should have rhythmically sprayed everything."
Thomas nodded as if he'd been anticipating this very question.
"That's quite simple to explain, isn't it? She was wearing a neckerchief when first attacked, then it fell away. Or perhaps the murderer ripped it from her to clean his blade. He might possess some neurosis or other."
Silence hung thick as the East End fog, as the vivid image Thomas created took life inside each of our minds. Uncle taught me the importance of removing my emotions from these types of cases, but it was hard to speak of a woman as if she were an animal being brought to the slaughterhouse, no matter how far she'd fallen from polite society. I swallowed hard. Thomas had a disturbing way of both predicting why the murderer acted as he did, and turning emotions off when it suited him, it seemed. It took a few seconds for my uncle to respond. But when he did, he was grinning like a madman, his eyes two sparks of fire set ablaze in his skull. I couldn't stop a twinge of jealousy from twisting in my gut. I couldn't tell if I was upset Uncle looked so pleased and I wasn't responsible, or if I wished to be interacting with the annoying boy myself. Out of everyone in this classroom, he at least wasn't cowed by the violence of this crime. Being afraid wouldn't find justice for the family. This boy seemed to understand that. I shook my thoughts free and listened to the lesson.
"Brilliant deduction skills, Thomas. I, too, believe our victim was attacked from behind while standing. The knife used was most likely between 6 and 8 inches long."
Uncle paused, showing the class about how big the blade was with his hands. Uneasiness crept into my blood. It would have been around the same size as the scalpel I'd used last night. Uncle cleared his throat.
"Judging from the jagged cut in the abdomen, I'd say the wound was inflicted post-mortem, where the body was discovered. I'd also venture our murderer was interrupted and didn't get what he was originally after. But I've an inkling he might be either left-handed or ambidextrous based on other evidence."
A boy sitting in the first row raised a shaking hand.
"What do you mean, what he was originally after?"
"Pray we don't find out."
Uncle twisted the corner of his pale moustache, a habit he often indulged while lost in thought.
I knew whatever he'd say next wouldn't be pleasant. Without realizing it, I'd grabbed the edges of my own seat so hard my knuckles were turning white. I loosened my grip slightly.
For the sake of this lesson, I'll divulge my theories.
Uncle glanced around the room once more.
I believe he was after her organs. Detective inspectors, however, do not share my sentiments on that aspect. I can only hope they're right.
While discussions broke out on Uncle's organ removal theory, I sketched the anatomical figures he'd hastily drawn on the chalkboard at the start of our lesson in order to clear my mind. Dissected pigs, frogs, rats, and even more disturbing things such as human intestines and hearts adorned the inside of my pages. My notebook was filled with images of things a lady had no business being fascinated by, yet I couldn't control my curiosity. A shadow fell across my notebook, and somehow I knew it was Thomas before he opened his mouth.
You ought to put the shadow on the left side of the body, else it looks like a pool of blood.
I tensed, but kept my lips shut as if they'd been sewn together by a reckless mortician. Flames quietly burned under my skin, and I cursed my body's reaction to such an aggravating boy. Thomas continued critiquing my work.
"Truly, you should erase those ridiculous smudges," he said. "The street lamp was coming from this angle. You've got it all terribly wrong."
"Truly, you should mind your own business." I closed my eyes, internally scolding myself. I'd been doing so well keeping quiet and not interacting with any of the boys. One slip could cost me my seat in class. Deciding one should never show a mad dog fear, I met Thomas's sharp gaze full on. A small smile played upon his lips, and my heart trotted in my chest like a carriage horse running through Trafalgar Square. I reminded myself he was a self-important ass, and decided the stutter in my heart was strictly due to nerves. I'd rather bathe in formaldehyde than be ousted from class by such a maddening boy, handsome though he might be.
"While I appreciate your observation," I said between clenched teeth, taking careful pains to deepen my voice, "I'd like it very much if you'd be so kind as to leave me to my studies."
His eyes danced as if he'd discovered a vastly entertaining secret, and I knew I was a mouse that had been caught by an all-too-clever cat.
"Right then, Mr..."
The way he emphasized Mr. left no room for misunderstanding. He was quite aware I was no young man, but was willing to play along, for God only knew what reason. I softened a bit at this show of mercy, dropping my disguised voice so only he could hear, my heart picking up speed once more at our shared secret. "Wadsworth. My name is Audrey Rose Wadsworth." A flash of understanding crossed his face, his attention flicking to my uncle, who was still inciting a heated discussion. He held his hand out, and I reluctantly shook it, hoping my palms wouldn't give away my nervousness. Perhaps having a friend to talk over cases might be nice. "I believe we met last night," I ventured, feeling a bit bolder. Thomas's brows knit together, and my newfound confidence plummeted. "In my uncle's laboratory?" Darkness shifted over his features.
"Apologies, but I haven't a clue what you're referring to. This is the first time we've spoken."
"We didn't exactly speak."
"It's nice to meet you, Wadsworth. I'm sure we'll have much to discuss in the near future." "Immensely near, actually, as I'm apprenticing this evening with your uncle. Perhaps you'll allow me the pleasure of testing out a few of my theories."
Another crimson wave washed over my cheeks. "Your theories on what exactly?"
"Your scandalous choice to attend this class, of course."
He grinned.
"It isn't every day you meet such an odd girl."
The friendly warmth I'd been feeling toward him froze over like a pond during a particularly frigid winter, especially since he appeared completely unaware of how irritating he was, smiling to himself without a care in the universe.
"I do love the satisfaction of solving a puzzle and proving myself right."
Somehow I found the strength to bite my retort back and offered a tight smile in its place. Aunt Amelia would be proud her lessons on etiquette stuck with me. "I am very much looking forward
to hearing your scintillating theory on my life choices, Mr.
Gentlemen, Uncle barked. If you please, I'd like each of you to write down your theories on Miss Mary Ann Nichols's murder and bring them to class tomorrow.
Thomas gave me one last devilish grin and turned back to his notes. As I closed my journal and gathered up my things, I couldn't help thinking he might prove an equally vexing mystery to solve. Chapter 3. Tea and Autopsies. Wadsworth Residence, Belgrave Square, 31st August 1888.
Where are you running off to at this hour?
Father stood near the grandfather clock in the foyer, his tone striking the same nervous chord as the beastly antique, while he checked his pocket watch. Only a handful of years separated uncle and father, and up until recently they could have passed for twins. A muscle in his square jaw twitched. Worse questions were coming. The urge to flee back up the grand staircase was suddenly overwhelming. I promised Uncle Jonathan I'd join him for tea. I watched him inhale a sharp breath and added quietly, turning down his invitation would have been rude. Before he offered any more thoughts on the matter, the parlour door swung open and my brother waltzed in, like a beam of sunshine set against the backdrop of a grey day. Taking quick note of the situation, he pounced.
I must say, everyone appears so downright cheerful this afternoon. It's rather disturbing. Give me a proper scowl, good man. Ah, he smiled at the glare Father levelled at him. That's the spirit. Excellent job, Father.
Nathaniel, Father warned, his glassy focus darting between us. This matter does not concern you.
Are we terrified to let the girl out of the protective bubble again? Heaven forbid she catch pox and perish. Oh, wait.
Nathaniel cocked his head.
That's happened before, hasn't it?
He dramatically grabbed my wrist, checking for a pulse, then staggered back.
By God, Father, she's quite alive.
Father's pale hand shook, and he blotted at his brow with a handkerchief, which was never a promising sign. Nathaniel usually managed to diffuse Father's anxiety with a well-placed quip. Today wasn't one of those days. I couldn't help noticing extra lines around Father's mouth, dragging his lips into a near-permanent frown. If he'd only let some of his endless worry go, it would erase a decade from his once handsome features. Strands of grey hair were also slipping in between his ashy blonde locks more and more lately.
I was just telling Father I'm on my way to the carriage, I said as pleasantly as I could manage, feigning ignorance of the volatile atmosphere. I'm meeting Uncle Jonathan.
Nathaniel clapped his gloved hands together, a sly smile spreading across his face. He couldn't resist assisting me with my chosen medical studies, mostly because my modern stance on why girls were equally capable of having a profession or apprenticeship offered endless amusement. My brother's love of arguing made him an excellent barrister in training, but his fickle attention would lead him elsewhere soon enough. His prior whims included a few months studying medicine, then art, then a horrendous effort with a violin, which went badly for all who had the misfortune of hearing him practice his scales. Though, as heir to our family legacy, he needn't learn a trade at all. It was merely something to pass idle hours and afternoons, besides drinking with his pompous friends.
Oh, that's right. I recall Uncle saying something about tea earlier in the week. Unfortunately, I had to decline his invitation, what with my studies and all.
Adjusting his gloves and smoothing his suit, Nathaniel stepped back and grinned.
Your dress is exceptional for today's weather and special occasion. 17 now, right? You're stunning, birthday girl. Don't you agree, Father?
Father scrutinized my ensemble. He was probably searching for a lie to prevent me from traveling to Uncle's home, but he wouldn't find one. I'd already packed the carriage with a change of simpler clothing. If he couldn't prove I was going to practice unholy acts upon the dead and risk infection, he couldn't very well stop me. For now, I was dressed in proper afternoon tea attire. My watered silk gown was the same shade of eggshell as my silk slippers, and my corset was tight enough to remind me it was there with each painful breath I took.
I was suddenly grateful for the rose-coloured gloves that buttoned up to my elbows. They were a fashionable way to hide how much my palms were sweating. Father ran a hand over his tired face.
Since it's your birthday, you may go there for tea and come straight back. I do not want you going anywhere else, nor do I want you engaged in any of that.
His hand fluttered about like an injured bird.
That activity your uncle is involved with. Understood?
I nodded, relieved, but Father wasn't through.
Should anything happen to your sister,
he said, staring at my brother,
I will hold you responsible.
Father held Nathaniel's gaze for a moment longer, then stalked from the room, leaving us in the wake of his storm. I watched as his broad form disappeared down the hallway, and until he slammed the door of his study shut with one backward swipe of his hand. I knew he'd light a cigar soon and lock himself away until morning, thoughts and memories of Mother plaguing him until he fell into a troubled sleep. I turned my attention to Nathaniel as he pulled out his favorite silver comb and ran it through his hair. Not one golden strand could ever be out of place, else the universe might possibly explode.
A bit warm for leather gloves, don't you think?
Nathaniel shrugged.
I'm on my way out.
As much as I wanted to speak with my brother, I had serious engagements that needed attending. Uncle was a creature of many habits, and tardiness wasn't tolerated. No matter that it was my birthday. Personally, I didn't think the dead would mind waiting 5 minutes to be cut open and explored, but I didn't dare say so out loud. I was there to learn, not ignite the demon sometimes lurking within him. Last time I questioned this rule, Uncle had me sopping bloody sawdust up for a month. I wasn't keen on receiving that punishment again. Blood had crusted my nail beds and was terrible to clean away before supper. Thank goodness Aunt Amelia hadn't been visiting. She would have fainted at the sight.
Do you want to have lunch tomorrow?
I asked. I can tell Martha to prepare something for us to bring to Hyde Park, if you'd like. We can even walk round the Serpentine. Nathaniel smiled a bit sadly.
Perhaps we can take a belated birthday stroll around the lake next week. I'd certainly like to know what you and Uncle Cadaver are up to in that house of horrors.
His eyes sparkled with a hint of trouble.
I worry about you seeing all that blood. Can't be good for your fragile womanly temperament.
Oh, where in a medical dictionary does it say a woman cannot handle such things? What is a man's soul made of that a woman's is not?
I teased.
I had no idea my innards were composed of cotton and kittens, while yours were filled with steel and steam-driven parts.
His voice softened, getting to the heart of what was truly bothering him.
Father will go berserk if he discovers what you're really doing. I fear his grasp on reality is most delicate these days. His delusions are becoming worrisome.
How so?
I caught him sharpening knives and talking to himself the other morning when he thought everyone was still asleep.
He rubbed his temples, his smile fading.
Perhaps he thinks he can stab germs before they enter our home now.
This was troubling news indeed. Last time Father got this way, he'd made me wear a facial mask each time I left the house to avoid breathing contagions. While I'd like to fancy myself above things such as vanity, I'd hated the stares I'd received when venturing out. Going through that again would be torturous. I plastered on a big smile.
You worry too much.
I kissed him on the cheek before heading for the door, my own tone lightening again.
If you're not careful, you'll end up losing all of your luxuriant hair.
Nathaniel chuckled at that.
Duly noted. Happy birthday, Audrey Rose. I do hope you have a wonderful time with whatever it is you're up to. Be careful, though. You know Uncle can be a bit mad.
20 minutes later, I was standing in the basement of Uncle's laboratory, getting acclimated to the smell of someone else's nightmare. Dead flesh had a sickeningly sweet undertone that always took a bit of time getting used to. Fresh, unharmed bodies gave off a scent similar to a raw chicken. Bodies deceased for a few days were a bit harder to ignore, no matter how much experience one had with them. Miss Nichols was murdered less than a day ago, but the strong dead rat scent confirmed her injuries were brutal. I said a silent prayer for her troubled soul and ravaged body before fully stepping into the room. A gas ceiling lamp threw sinister shadows against the brocade wallpaper, while two familiar figures peered over a corpse laid out on the mortuary table. It didn't take a genius to deduce the body belonged to our subject from class, and the extra person in the room was my infuriating classmate. I knew from experience not to interrupt Uncle while he was examining evidence, and was especially grateful for that rule when he described the mutilated neck again, in even greater detail, for Thomas. There was something familiar about the woman, and I couldn't stop myself from imagining her life prior to ending up before us. Perhaps there were people who loved her, a husband or children, and were mourning her loss this very moment, no longer caring that she'd fallen on hard times. Death was not prejudiced by mortal things, such as station or gender. It came for kings and queens and prostitutes alike, often leaving the living with regrets. What might we have done differently if we'd known the end was so near? I shut those thoughts off. I was wandering dangerously close to an emotional door I'd already locked. Distraction was something I needed, and thankfully, this was the perfect place for that very thing. Mahogany shelves lined the walls around the room with hundreds of glass specimen jars. They'd been carefully catalogued and displayed in alphabetical order, a task I was given last autumn and had only recently finished. Overall, I'd counted nearly 700 different samples, a brilliant collection for a museum, let alone a single household. I trailed a finger over the preserved body nearest me. The label written in my tiny cursive identified it as a cross-section of a frog. The dulled ammonia scent of formalin permeated everything in the subterranean lair, even the sweetness of decay, but was strangely comforting nonetheless. I quietly picked up the liver I'd removed yesterday and added it to the shelves. It was my very first addition to them. My attention snagged on what I assumed were Miss Nichols's clothes. Bloodstains were hard to see on the dark material. However, given the nature of her attack, I knew they were there. Small, lace-up boots were covered in mud, smudging the table on which they rested. They were well-worn, telling of her poverty. A chill, having nothing to do with the macabre scene unfolding across the room, crawled down my spine. Keeping the temperature quite low in this part of the house was essential, else the specimens rotted too fast. The less constricting muslin dress I was wearing now offered little in the way of protection against the chilly air, but I preferred working in it over my finer corseted one, even as I rubbed the goose flesh from my arms. I scanned the wall opposite me, containing medical journals and tools that, to an outside observer, might seem a bit frightening. The curved, scythe-like blade of the amputation knife, the bone saws, and the imposing glass and metal syringes wouldn't be out of place in a gothic novel, such as both Nathaniel's and my childhood favourite, Frankenstein. They could easily be thought of as the devil's design, if one was inclined to think such superstitious notions. Like father. The room's eerie silence was broken, as Uncle called out basic facts, such as height, gender, and hair and eye colour, while scouring the body for other traumas sustained during the murder. Facts I had already memorized from my journal entry. I watched Thomas write notes onto a medical sheet with mechanical precision, his fingers more ink-stained than they were in class. Note-taking was generally my area of assistance during these procedures. I stood patiently, breathing in the chemical air and listening to the gentle sounds of flesh splaying, trying to ignore the sick churn of my gut. Settling my nerves always took several moments. A few breaths later, Uncle noticed me standing in the corner and signaled for me to grab an apron and join them. As I moved closer to the cadaver, it was as if a door had closed between my heart and head, sealing all emotions on the opposite side. Once I was standing over the body, I no longer saw the person she was in life. I only saw the shell left behind, and curiosity took hold in the worst of ways. She'd morphed from a kindly enough-looking woman into another faceless corpse. I'd had plenty of experience with them this summer. Strips of cloth covered parts of her to keep her decent, though there wasn't anything decent about her state. Her skin was paler than the finest hand-painted pottery Mother had inherited from her grandmother in India, except along her jawline, where dark bruising was evident. Hard living stole the softness I imagined she once had, and death was not gentle when it took her in its unforgiving embrace. At least her eyes were closed. That was where the semi-peacefulness ended. According to Uncle, she was missing 5 teeth, and her tongue had also sustained a laceration, indicating she was likely struck to either stun or knock her unconscious before the throat slitting. Those were the kinder injuries. My gaze drifted to her lower abdomen, where a major injury was located on her left side. Uncle Jonathan hadn't exaggerated in class. This cut was jagged and extremely deep. A few smaller slices ran along the right side of her torso, but weren't nearly as bad from what I could tell. I saw why Uncle thought someone who had use of both hands might be responsible. The bruising on her jaw indicated someone had grabbed her face with the left hand, and the incision on the left side of her body was most likely made by someone using the right, unless there was more than one butcher on the loose. I shook my head and focused on her upper body again. The knife wounds to her neck told of an attack bred by violence. They were surprisingly easy to look at in my new emotionally detached state, however, and I wondered briefly if Aunt Amelia would say that was another strike against my moral character. "Girls should be concerned with lace, not moral disgrace," she'd say. I dreamed of a day when girls could wear lace and makeup, or no makeup at all, and don burlap sacks if they desired, to their chosen profession, without it being deemed inappropriate. Uncle suddenly jumped back and sneezed. Thoughts of contracting airborne diseases crowded into my brain. I collected myself for a minute. Father's fears would not become my own and hold me back from what needed to be done. Uncle snapped his fingers, pointing to one of 4 surgical knives lying on a metal tray. I snatched it up and handed it to him, grabbing each used tool and setting it in an alcohol bath after he was through with it. When it came time for the organ removal, I had individual trays and specimen glass ready before Uncle asked for them. I knew my job well. He grunted his approval, then weighed the kidneys one at a time. "The left kidney is approximately 137 grams. Thomas scratched the information down, quickly returning his focus to my uncle's next words. He was silent while absorbed in his work, my presence like a piece of furniture, wholly unnoticed until needed. "The right is a bit on the small side, coming in around 119. Uncle removed a small piece of each organ, placing them on petri dishes for further testing. This same routine went on for the heart, liver, intestines, and brain. My uncle's clean white apron gradually became bloodier, but he methodically washed his hands after each dissection to avoid contaminating the evidence. There was no proof such contaminations could occur, but Uncle had his own theories on the matter.
"Conventional society be damned," he'd bellow. "I know what I know."
Not much separated him from a butcher in appearance. I supposed even deceased humans were nothing more than animals being flayed open in the name of science instead of nourishment. Everything looked the same when you removed its top layers. I nearly laughed out loud at my absurd thoughts. 2 times a year, Aunt Amelia and Cousin Liza stayed with us. Part of their visit included socializing me with girls my age by hosting lavish tea parties. Aunt Amelia hoped I'd continue attending them on my own, but I'd put an end to that. The girls at tea didn't understand my mind, which was precisely why I'd declined their invitations over the last several months. I hated the pity in their eyes, and couldn't imagine explaining my afternoons to them. Some of them found it obscene to dip their butter knives into lemon curd. What horror they'd feel at seeing my scalpel disappearing into bloody tissue! Something cool and wet seeped into the bottom of my shoes. I hadn't noticed the pool of blood I'd been standing in. I quickly fetched a bag of sawdust and sprinkled it across the floor like a fine layer of tan-colored snow. I'd have to get rid of my slippers before I went home later. No need to frighten my newest lady's maid any more than I normally did when I came home splattered in the day's work. Uncle snapped his fingers, returning me to the task at hand. Once I'd disinfected the bone saw Uncle used to open the cranium and laid it back on the shelf, the autopsy was complete. Uncle Jonathan stitched the body together like a skilled tailor whose medium was flesh instead of fine fabric. I watched as the Y incision he'd made earlier turned from darkened crimson to black thread. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Thomas furiously sketching the body in its last state, his pencil slowing, then speeding across the paper. I grudgingly had to admit his drawing was really quite good. The details he captured would aid us with the investigation once the body was taken back to the morgue.
"Do you recognize the deceased, Audrey Rose?"
My attention snapped to Uncle. He was removing his apron, his gaze locked onto mine. I bit my lip, studying the woman's mangled face. There was that gnawing sense of familiarity, but I still couldn't place her. I slowly shook my head, feeling defeated.
"She worked in your household, briefly."
Guilt sunk its claws into me. I still didn't recognize the poor woman. What a wretched thing, taking no notice of someone in my very own home. Miss Nichols deserved better from me, and the world. I felt utterly terrible. Uncle turned to the sink.
"You would have been ill at the time."
Thomas jerked his attention up, reading my body for any signs of lingering disease. As if he even cared. He was probably worried this news might pose some sort of potential hazard for himself. My face burned, and I busied myself with the specimens.
"What have either of you learned from our little exercise today?"
Uncle Jonathan interrupted my thoughts, scrubbing his hands and forearms with a block of carbolic soap.
"Any interesting theories?"
I jumped at the opportunity to speak my mind, now that we weren't surrounded by students. A small part of me was also excited for a chance to show off my theories in front of Thomas. I wanted him to see he wasn't the only one with an interesting mind. "Whoever is responsible for the murder must have some sort of training in the medical field," I said. "He might even be a mortuary student, or someone who's taken surgical classes at the very least." Uncle nodded.
"Good. Tell me more."
Feeling bolstered by Uncle's approval, I circled the body. "She might have been grabbed by her face, then received a blow, rendering her unconscious." I thought of the incisions and areas of the body that were injured. "Also, she might have been brought elsewhere. Our murderer needed time to perform his surgery without interruption." An image of our former servant being beaten, then dragged to some forgotten cellar or other damp, shadowy place, set my skin crawling around my body like worms in a graveyard. Though I didn't remember her, the mere thought of her living and breathing and working in my house made me feel responsible for her in a way. I wanted to help her now in death, though I'd failed her miserably in life. Maybe she'd still be alive and reputably employed if I'd been brave enough to speak out against Father's chronic need to change staff every few weeks. My hands fisted at my sides. I refused, absolutely refused, to let this cruel treatment of a woman stand. I'd do everything in my power to solve this case for Miss Nichols, and for any other voiceless girl or woman society ignored. Mother would have done the same. All other thoughts left my mind in place of the horrific reality we were dealing with. "He must have slit her throat in a location where a large amount of blood wouldn't draw attention. Possibly he took her to the slaughterhouse and did it there." Thomas snorted from his station near the body. I whipped around to properly glare at him, removing the ties from my apron with as much venom as I could inject into the action and tossing it into a laundry bin. I knew my face must be flushed again, but hoped he'd misinterpret the cause. "Why is that funny, Mr.?" He composed himself and stood.
"Mr. Thomas Cresswell at your service, Miss Wadsworth."
Bending slightly at the waist in a mock bow, he came to his full, impressive height and smiled.
"I find it amusing because it's an extraordinary amount of work for our murderer. Hauling her off to the slaughterhouse after he went through the trouble of knocking her unconscious?"
He tisked.
"Seems rather unnecessary."
"Pardon me, but you don't..." Thomas closed the journal he'd been sketching in and walked around the corpse, rudely speaking over me.
"Especially when he could easily slice her open at the river, allowing evidence to wash away without dirtying his hands further. Not to mention..."
He pointed to her soiled boots.
The mud caked onto her heels.
I scrunched my nose as if something worse than rotten flesh was in the air. I hated the fact I'd missed making the connection between the dirt on her boots and the muddy banks of the river. I hated even more that Thomas hadn't missed it.
"Hasn't rained here in almost a week," he went on, "and there are a number of dark corners near the Thames, ripe for leather aprons picking."
"You just stated it was ridiculous to presume he killed her at the slaughterhouse," I said, narrowing my eyes. "Now you've gone and called him a leather apron?"
"I was referencing the leather apron. Haven't you seen a paper this afternoon?"
Thomas studied me as if I were a specimen he'd possibly like to dissect.
"Surely choosing the perfect silken shoes isn't more important than finding a blood-crazed murderer. Yet, look at those things on your feet, getting all stained and gory. Is your interest in science simply an attempt at finding a husband? Shall I grab my coat, then?"
He flashed a roguish grin at my scowl.
"I'm sure your uncle won't mind stopping his investigation to chaperone us."
He turned to Uncle.
"Would you, Dr. Wadsworth? I do admit your niece is quite beautiful."
I averted my gaze. I'd forgotten less frilly shoes in my mad rush to exit the house. Not that there was anything wrong with my slippers. If I chose to wear them to post-mortems, it was my choice and my choice alone. Perhaps I'd do it from now on simply to irk him. "You know an awful lot about how this murderer thinks," I said sweetly. "Perhaps we should investigate your whereabouts that evening, Mr. Cresswell." He gazed at me, a dark brow arched in contemplation. I swallowed hard, but held his stare. A minute later he nodded, as if coming to some sort of conclusion about me.
"If you're going to follow me around at night, Miss Wadsworth,"
his attention flicked to my feet,
"I'd advise you to wear more sensible shoes."
I opened my mouth to retort, however Mr. Thomas Cresswell spoke over me again. "Brash fool."
"The leather apron is what they're calling our murderer."
He moved around the examination table, stalking closer to where I stood. I wanted to back away, but he held me in his magnetic orbit. He stopped before me, a softness briefly flashing across his features, and my heart picked up speed. Lord help the girl he set those eyes on for good. His boyish vulnerability was a weapon, powerful and disarming. I was thankful I wasn't the kind of girl to lose my mind over a handsome face. He'd need to work a bit harder to gain my affection.
"To answer your earlier question, Dr. Wadsworth," he said, tearing his gaze from mine, his tone more serious than before, "I fully believe this is only the beginning. What we have on our hands is the start of a career murderer. No one with that kind of surgical prowess would commit one murder then stop."
His lips quirked slightly when he noticed my incredulous expression.
"I know I wouldn't. One taste of warm blood is never enough, Miss Wadsworth."
Chapter 4. A Dance with the Devil. Wadsworth Residence, Belgrave Square, 7th September, 1888. Leather Apron and the Whitechapel Murderer were the headlines of the last week. Everywhere I looked, a new theory was introduced by another supposed expert in the field. Detective inspectors had several doctors examine the body of Miss Nichols and, for the most part, they'd all come to the same conclusions as Uncle Jonathan. Most everyone disagreed with Uncle's theory of her being assaulted while standing, however. They did agree her throat was slashed prior to the incisions made along her abdomen, and that whoever was responsible was unlikely to simply stop now. East End residents were terrified to go out after sunset, fearing every shadowy figure was the depraved murderer. Prostitutes were warned to be on high alert, but their need to pay for lodging kept them from completely abandoning the streets. My father was worse than ever, coming unhinged, it seemed, every time I left the house. It was becoming harder to sneak about or come up with excuses for leaving that he didn't question. He'd let go all of our maids and hired a whole new lot, his paranoia of them infecting our family with Lord only knew what overshadowing his reason. There was no point telling him that new servants were more likely to bring infection in, as they'd been outside our home and in the scary, disease-spreading world. Pretty soon I feared he'd be escorting me everywhere himself. Unfortunately, that meant attending Uncle's forensic medicines class had become nearly impossible,
though I was fortunate I could still make it to the laboratory. I fully believe this is only the beginning. Mr. Thomas Cresswell's ominous warning replayed through my mind each passing day. It felt like the uneasy stillness before the storm, and I found myself even more restless than usual at night. I had a hard time fully believing his theory, though. The thought of any more murders taking place was simply out of the question. I'd never heard of a career murderer before. It seemed Thomas was looking for another outlet to show off his brilliance, and I wanted nothing more than to prove him wrong, potentially earning more of Uncle's respect in the process. Between my desire for Uncle's approval and my connection to Miss Nichols, I was determined to help solve this case. I tried approaching my brother to discuss his thoughts on it, but he'd been preoccupied with studying and couldn't spare any time, which left me with too much time to think about death and the finality of it all. Nathaniel always assured me what happened wasn't my fault, but his comfort didn't take the sting out of my chest each time Father stared at me with such overwhelming fear. As far as he was concerned, it was his duty to protect me against everything in the world. Mother didn't die nursing Nathaniel back from scarlet fever after all. He didn't have to watch her face flush with that horrible rash and see her tongue swell because my brother had been weak. Her already damaged heart didn't break fully because Nathaniel had brought infection to our home. I couldn't help feeling as if I were Father's useless, murdering daughter who looked too much like her mother, a constant reminder of all he'd lost, of all I'd stolen away from him, the night I took my first fever-free breath, and Mother took her last. I was the reason for his growing madness, and I never let myself forget it. When I closed my eyes, I still saw the hospital staff in their long dresses and starched aprons, their solemn faces turning away from my ear-splitting screams as Mother's chest stuttered and fell still forever. I banged on her sternum with both fists, my tears falling on her beautifully stitched dressing gown, but she didn't stir again. No 12-year-old should watch her mother's soul drift into the abyss. It was the first time I'd ever felt helpless. God had failed me. I'd prayed and prayed the way Mother always said I should. And for what? Death still claimed her in the end. It was then I knew I'd rely on something more tangible than holy spirits. Science never abandoned me the way religion had that night. Forsaking the Holy Father was considered a sin, and I did it repeatedly. Each time my blade met with flesh, I sinned more and welcomed it. God no longer held dominion over my soul. This evening my thoughts were treacherously loud and impossible to quiet down. I tossed back and forth in my thin nightdress, kicked my sheets off, and finally poured myself a glass of water from a pitcher on my bedside table. Blast it all! Sleep wasn't going to find me, that much I was certain of. My limbs itched with the need to get out and do something. Or perhaps I simply needed to escape from the confines of my room and all the woeful thoughts that came with the darkness. Each day that passed was a failure to help Miss Nichols's family find peace. I'd already failed her once. I wouldn't fail again so miserably. I clenched my fists. I could do the safe and reasonable thing, waiting in Uncle's laboratory until another victim showed up. Or I could act now. Tonight. I could gather clues that might help, impressing both Thomas and Uncle in the process. The more I thought on it, the surer I became of my decision. Mother used to say, "Roses have both petals and thorns, my dark flower. You needn't believe something weak because it appears delicate. Show the world your bravery." Mother had a weak heart and was kept from much physical activity as a child, but she'd found other ways to prove her strength. One needn't be strong in only physical matters. A strong mind and will were fierce to behold as well. "You're right, Mother." I paced along the deep gold Persian rug in my room, relishing the coldness of the hardwood when my soles found the edges of the carpet. Before I knew what I was doing, I found myself standing in front of my looking glass, dressed all in black. "It's time for bravery."
pulling my dark hair into a simple braid and pinning it about my crown. I tucked a few wayward strands behind my ears. My dress was a simple design with long-fitted sleeves, a small bustle, and light cotton fabric. I ran my hands down the front of it,